From the unexplained to the mundane, come join us on a journey to the fringe.
Hello and welcome to Journey to the Fringe, where we guarantee weekly episodes or the next one's free.
Mm-hmm. We stand by it.
I didn't actually run that one by Chelsea. I thought she would just kind of agree with me on that.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out if we ever have to. I don't know how we've done this. For people that are fairly not great at consistency, I think we're running like 6 seasons of not missing a Friday.
You can't just say that out loud on a recorded podcast.
I can, and I did.
That might create us some problems.
We are your podcast hosts, Taylor and Chelsea, and here today going over a very famous Bigfoot story from way back in the day.
What could this even be?
Chelsea, I'm sure you know the story. It is ancient. It is kind of everywhere. And I kind of forgot it existed till I saw it in passing for research on something else I've been working on. But as I looked into it, I realized there's a lot that's been happening on it in the last decade. So I thought it'd be good to go over this story and make sure everybody knows it and knows how it's gone since you maybe last heard about it.
Let's hear it.
Chelsea, if I say the name Zana, does it ring any bells for you?
Vaguely. Is this the circus one?
No.
Freak
this
show?
Is Zana Abkhazia.
No.
In Russia. Okay, this is the story of a Russian Bigfoot from way back in the day. We're talking the 1860s.
Holy crap.
It is fairly well documented, as well as it could be for the time. And it is fairly well regarded overall that something weird did happen in this area of Russia. I do have at least one of the people who got secondhand information, wrote it down, and that's the story we're going to be going over for this. And then from there, we're going to talk about what's happened since then.
Okay.
This comes from the book In the Footsteps of the Russian Snowman by Dmitry Bayanov. In Abkhazia, Western Caucasus, relict hominoids are called obnagwa. While collecting reports in 1962, a colleague of Boris Porshnev, zoologist Professor Alexander Mashkovtsev, heard and studied the story of Zana. Subsequently, Porshnev took over where his late companion left off. The following information is borrowed from Porshnev's work, The Struggle for Troglodytes. Zana was a female Abnayu who had been caught and tamed and who lived and died within the memory of a number of people still alive at the time of the research. She was buried near the village of Takina in the Okamchiri district of Kazia in the 1880s or 1890s. The manner of her capture is vague. Some said it was not chance. Hunters familiar with an age-old technique tied her up and when she furiously fought back, hit her with cudgels, gagged her mouth with felt, and shackled her legs to a log.
Oh, gosh.
Probably she had already changed hands by sale when she became property of the ruling prince, D.M. Achba, who was the titular head of the Zadan region. She passed into the possession of one of his vassals named Cholokwa, and still later, she was presented to a nobleman, Ejiganaba, who visited the region. He took her away, still shackled and chained, to his estate in the village of Takina on the Mokva River, 78 kilometers from Sukhumi. At first, Ganaba lodged her in a very strong enclosure, and nobody ventured in to give her food, for she acted like a wild beast. It was thrown to her. She dug herself a hole in the ground and slept in it. For the first 3 years, she lived in this wild state, gradually becoming tamer. After 3 years, she was moved to a wattle fence enclosure under an awning near the house, tethered at first, but later she was let loose to wander about.
The story's messed up.
Yeah, it really is weird. And it's hard to verify all of this because this is all very secondhand information,
yeah.
Even the guy writing it.
Okay.
However, she never went far from the place where she received her food. She could not endure warm rooms and, year-round, in any weather, slept outdoors in a hole that she made herself under the awning. Villagers teased her with sticks thrust through the wattle fence, and she would snatch them with fury, bare her teeth, and howl. Her skin was black or dark gray, and her whole body covered with reddish-black hair. The hair on her head was tousled and thick, hanging mane-like down her back. She could not speak. Over decades that she lived with people, Zana did not learn a single Abkhaz word. She only made inarticulate sounds and mutterings, and cries when irritated. But she reacted to her name, carried out commands given by her master, and was scared when he shouted at her. And this, despite the fact that she was very tall, massive, and broad, with huge breasts and buttocks, muscular arms and legs, and fingers that were longer and thicker than human fingers, she could splay her toes widely and move apart the big toe. From remembered descriptions given to Mashkovtsev, and Porchnev, her face was terrifying, broad with high cheekbones, flat nose, turned out nostrils, muzzle-like jaws, wide mouth with large teeth, low forehead, and eyes of a reddish tinge. But the most frightening feature was her expression, which was purely animal, not human. Sometimes she would give a spontaneous laugh, baring those big white teeth of hers. The latter were so strong that she easily cracked the hardest walnuts. She lived for many years without showing any change, no gray hairs, no falling teeth, keeping strong and fit as ever. Her athletic power was enormous. She would outrun a horse and swim across the wild Mulkva River even when it rose in violent high tide. Seemingly without effort, she lifted with one hand an 80-kilo sack of flour and carried it uphill from the watermill to the village. She climbed trees to get fruit and to gorge herself with grapes. She would pull down a whole vine growing around the tree. She ate whatever was offered to her, including hominy and meat. Oh. Hominy is a type of corn. With bare hands and enormous gluttony. She loved wine and was allowed her fill, after which she would sleep for hours in a swoon-like state. She liked to lie in a cool pool side by side with buffaloes. At night, she used to roam the surrounding hills. She wielded big sticks against dogs and on other perilous occasions. She had a curious obsession for playing with stones, knocking one against another and splitting them. She took swims the year round and preferred to walk naked even in the winter, tearing dresses that she was given to shreds. However, she showed more tolerance toward a loincloth. Sometimes she went into the house, but the women were afraid of her and came near only when she was in gentle moods. When angry, she presented a scary sight and could even bite, but she obeyed her master, Edgy Ganava, and he knew how to bring her to heel. Adults used her as a boogeyman figure with children, although Zana never actually attacked children. She was trained to perform simple domestic tasks, such as grinding grain for flour, bringing home firewood and water, or sacks to and from the watermill, or pull her master's high boots off. But she became the mother of human children, and this is the wondrous side of her whole life story, very important for the science of genetics. Zana was pregnant several times by various men, and giving birth without assistance, she always washed the newborn child in the cold water spring. The half-breed infants, unable to survive her ablutions, died. So, subsequently, when Zana gave birth, the villagers began taking the newborn babies away from her in good times and reared them themselves. Four times this happened, and the children, two sons and two daughters, grew up as humans, fully fledged and normal men and women who could talk and possessed reason. It is true that they had some strange physical and mental features, but nonetheless, they were fully capable of engaging in work and social life. The eldest son's name was Dejanda, and the eldest daughter was Kojanar. The second daughter was named Gamasa, and the younger son Kuwait, who died in 1954. All had descendants of their own scattered across Abkhazia.
I do remember the story now.
Was it the part about her dipping them in the water?
Like all of it, having kids and everything.
Okay.
I'm familiar with the story now that you've refreshed my memory.
Oh, good. And I'm going to keep refreshing everybody else's memory who's listening.
No, you can stop now.
Oh, good. There were rumors that the father of Gamasa and Kuwait was in fact Edgy Ganava himself, but in the census they were put under a different surname and their family name became Sabekia. It is significant that Zana was buried in the family cemetery of the Ganavas, and that the youngest children of Zana were brought up by Ganava's wife. Gamasa and Kuwait were both powerfully built and had dark skin, but they inherited scarcely anything from Zana's facial appearance. The complex of features inherited from their father was dominant in them and overruled the mother's line of descent. Kuwait, who died at the age of 65 or 70, was described by his fellow villagers as little different from the human norm, except for certain small divergences. He was extremely strong, difficult to deal with, and quick to pick a fight. In fact, he lost his right hand after one of the many fights he had with his fellow villagers, but his left hand sufficed him to and do other work on a collective farm and even climb trees. When old, he moved to the town of Tegavarcheli, where he eventually died, but he was taken back for burial at Tekina. The next stage of the Zana case was taken up by attempts to find her grave and skeleton. Here's what Boris Porchnev says about his first efforts in that direction. In September of 1964, the archaeologist V.S. Orelkin and I made our first attempt to find Zana's grave. The cemetery was wildly overgrown, and only the 10-year-old mound over Kuwait's grave could be picked out among the bracken covering the hillside. Nobody else had been buried since then. Zana must be somewhere near. We asked the old residents, and the last scion of the Ganaba Dan, 79 years old, Kenton. He was clear that we should dig under a pomegranate tree. What was found there turned out to be the remains of one of Zana's grandchildren who had died early, for the profile that we established from the skull was extraordinarily like the profile of Zana's two living grandchildren whom I myself had met. After two more expeditions, the search party had still not found Zana's bones, though in a third attempt in 1965, they found what are probably the bones of Gamasa as they present slight but definite paleoanthropic features. After the passing of Portionev, it fell to my lot to continue the search. I headed 3 expeditions to Abkhazia in search of Zana's skeleton. In 71, 75, and 78, which merits a separate story, our difficulty was that by that time, the last scion of the Ganaba Dan had finally passed away and nobody knew exactly where Zana's grave was. We put in a tremendous amount of spade work on that hillside, digging sticky clayey earth under the almost daily downpours. During the second expedition, I was taken seriously ill with an illness which doctors failed to identify. We never found a skeleton that would fit Zana's features as described by witnesses. It was then decided to exhume the skulls of Kuit, Zana's younger son, whose grave was still well indicated. Professor Borchak Abramovich assisted me in that digging. I brought the skull to Moscow, where it was studied by 2 physical anthropologists, M.A. Kolodieva and M.M. Gerasimova. The results of the study were reported by me at the Relict Hominoid Research Seminar at the Moscow Natural Society and published in 1987. That's the story of Zana, more or less. We got it like 80 years after it purportedly happened. Even there's no children of hers left. There are some grandchildren to see, like, but living,
like descendants of
alive,
her.
Yeah.
Okay.
But like, even when the stories were told, nobody had actually met Zana.
Okay, it's just like legend at this point.
Yeah. But everybody kind of agrees on the story, and this is as far back as we can go look at it, is this guy who went and visited the town, found the son's skull. So the research on Zana began in 1962 when Moscow biologist Alexander Mashkovtsev traveled to the village. There he heard the stories about Zana, those are what we were hearing there, from the local residents. He soon passed them on to the historian cryptozoologist Portionev. Together with colleagues, Portionev went to Tikhina to find elderly people who had seen Zana in person after more than 7 years had passed since her death. Though these witnesses were over 100 years old, they still vividly remembered the events related to Zana. And sorry, I misspoke. They did meet her.
And they...
just super old.
In the story that was being relayed, it said that Zana did not age. So I thought
she did die eventually.
She might have been eternal based on that, but okay, she did die.
But they don't actually know when she died, or at least from the story that it's told, what she died from.
Well, it doesn't seem like a lot of people really gave a shit about her other than the fact that she was abnormal.
Yeah, and what they believed to
like,
be
it seems like she was horribly abused.
Oh yeah, it might be a little sad as we get going too, but there's a bit more still. In 1975, historian Igor Dmitrievich Burtsev continued the research, and initially no one could locate Zana's grave, but the burial site of her son Kuit, who died in 1954, was preserved. That's the part we were listening to at the end of that story. Burtsev also met Kuit's daughter Reza, born in 1934, from his second marriage. According to Burtsev, Reza had African facial features, slightly curly hair, and grayish skin. And after a long search, Burtsev found Zana's grave. He conducted excavations and obtained the skull of Kuit and presumably Zana herself. So in 75, they did locate it. Years later, Burtsev's research caught the attention of American scientists studying the genome and lifestyles of Neanderthals. In a laboratory for Neanderthal genetics at New York University, Burtsev brought Kuit Sabekia's skull after struggling to get permission to exhume the grave. Studies based on the skull material were supposed to determine whether Zana was a Neanderthal. And as of 2015, the last kind of notice I know of for sure where these skulls are, they're still in Moscow. Many theories were out there about what Zana could be. There is a local Bigfoot legend in the area. They're called the Almasti. Some people believe that Zana was part of the Almasti, the caucus analog for Bigfoot. Locals described her as unusually strong, fast, resistant to cold, traits that fuel claims that she was a surviving relict hominin. And this interpretation dominates, especially in cryptozoological writings, for decades from when she was discovered. You also might notice near the end there of my talking, some people believe that she might have been related or had Neanderthal genetics, so there might have been like a lost breed of Neanderthals that survived in Siberia.
Okay.
Is either a Neanderthal remnant or a Denisovan or a previously unknown archaic species preserved in isolation. These ideas persisted because no genetic data existed, and kind of her description made her sound like what we think of as a Neanderthal. And others think that she might have been a feral human or an isolated mountain population that was living there. Just some group that's weirdly evolved on their own out there. And interesting stuff that comes around 2015 is there's a theory that Zana, who had dark skin, could have been a representative of an Afro-Abkhazian group. However, eyewitnesses who saw Zana claim that she had nothing in common with them. The main argument against her Afro-Abkhazian origin was her abundant body hair. According to writer Fazil Iskander, elderly people who knew Zana may have exaggerated her body hair to attract public attention to the village. Descriptions of Zana herself exist only in stories, and photographs of her descendants and one of their skulls do not exhibit the traits that would prove Zana was a relict hominid. The skulls, which some enthusiasts believe belong to Zana, as reported by Burtsev, is not necessarily hers. And this is parts written before DNA testing could be done on the skulls.
That was going to be one of my questions.
This burial was distinctive for the crouched position of the body, while Islamic burial customs require a body to be laid out straight. The skull itself belonged to an elderly woman and had distinct equatorial features, pronounced prognathism, a convex forehead, slightly forward-facing cheekbones, a wide nose, flattened nasal bones, and a broad interocular space. Basically, what they're describing with those words is what you would think of as a person living in Africa.
Okay.
Queet's skull is indeed impressive, powerful brow ridges, a large face, wide nose, and a pronounced occiput. However, by all accounts, he was Homo sapien. The man was undoubtedly remarkable, but his size was not unusually rare for the Caucasus. The large brow ridge does not have the character of a ridge as it would in a Neanderthal, and the so-called supraorbital triangle, flattening at the base of the zygomatic process of the frontal bone, a typical sapien trait, is clearly expressed. The temporal bone at the lower jaw structure are also distinctly modern.
Are we still talking about...
We're talking about her son.
Oh, okay.
So they've studied both skulls. Now, the next theory pops up in 2015 as to what Zana was, and I think this one's pretty interesting, Chelsea.
Okay.
Brian Sykes, professor from University of Oxford, finally starts studying the DNA. So he analyzes the DNA of Zana's descendant, the son that we have the skeleton for, and it's discovered that they have West African genes. But surprisingly, this DNA did not match any known modern African group. Sykes theorizes that the ancestors may have lived in the Caucasus Mountains for generations after leaving Africa over 100,000 years ago. Saliva tests were carried out on Zana's living relatives, and a tooth was available from the remains of her deceased son, Kuwait. The findings are controversial. This comes after geneticists' involvement in other high-profile cases dealing with disputed DNA samples and conclusions. In 2014, Sykes and colleagues published a study of their findings in mitochondrial 12S RNA sequencing in samples of anomalous primates, popularly called Yetis, and the team concluded the samples connected the legend of the Yeti with a Paleolithic polar bear. Zana's existence seems to be established historically by witnesses and residents of Abkhazia, yet experts wrestle with the background and biological identity. Was she simply a victimized woman suffering from a disability or a runaway slave? His theory was that there's an entirely separate, like, migration of people out of Africa about 100,000 years ago who are living, like, isolated in Siberia, so they maintained, like, their black skin and would still be existing there, I guess, and she would have been, like, kidnapped from that tribe out in Siberia.
Interesting theory. How would they have evolved, though, to be able to live without clothes?
That's a really good question. I think you can attribute that part of the legend as legend and nothing more.
Yeah, okay.
I think you gotta accept parts of the story as we keep going seem like they might have just been made up by the people.
I accept it all, don't worry.
Okay, good. The last study that was done on this was in 2021, and I do think this puts the whole story to bed as to what happened. June 14th, 2021, a paper was posted in PubMed Central for Medicine, article titled The Genomic Origin of Zana of Abkhazia, written by Ashot Margarian, Mikhail Holger Sinding, Christian Caro, Vladimir Yamshchikov, Igor Burtsev, and Thomas Gilbert. They finally did a study, they confirmed that the two skulls were related, and they said the following: enigmatic phenomenon have sparked the imagination of people around the globe into creating folkloric creatures. One prime example is Zana of Abkhazia, a well-documented 19th century female who was captured living in the forest. Zana's appearance was sufficiently unusual that she was referred to by locals as an Almasty, the analog of Bigfoot in the Caucasus. Although the exact origin of Zana's burial site was unknown, the grave of her son Kuwait was identified in 1971. The genomes of Kuwait and the alleged Zana skeleton were sequenced using ancient DNA techniques. The identical mtDNA and parent offspring relationship between the two indicated that the unknown woman was indeed Zana. So they were able to confirm that that was her son, and therefore by extension the skull they found was Zana. Population genomic analysis demonstrated that Zana's immediate genetic ancestry can likely be traced to present day East African populations. We speculate that Zana might have had a genetic disorder such as congenital generalized hypertrichosis, which could partially explain her strange behavior, lack of speech, and long body hair. Our findings elucidate Zana's unfortunate story and provide a clear example of how prejudice of the time led to notions of cryptic hominids that are still held and transmitted by some today. In summary, our results based on genome-wide analysis reveal that Zana's genome had a sub-Saharan African genetic origin, consistent with the results of previously unpublished craniometric and mtDNA analyses. This suggested that her presence in the region may have been linked to the Ottoman Empire slave trade to Istanbul. That was one of the main hubs for the slave trade in the region in the 19th century. Moreover, Zana's largely Eastern African ancestry is consistent with the historical records indicating that most of the African slaves in the Ottoman Empire originated around the areas of Africa's Great Lakes and present-day Sudan. The contemporary reports and subsequent tales of Zana's wildness were at least partially based on some of her unusual physical characteristics, such as the lack of speech, intellectual disability, and long hair covering her body, to name a few. With the genomic data clearly rejecting all non-human hypotheses, we speculate that if these descriptions of her physical characteristics are accurate, she may have had a rare human genetic disorder such as congenital generalized hypertrichosis, a syndrome with dysmorphic facial features, intellectual disability, and hypertrichosis. And I need to add, they did have a section on ethics in their paper. Following her capture in the forest, Zana was deprived of her basic human rights and treated as a slave. She was kept in captivity, likely forced to have sexual relations with local men, and worked in forced labor conditions. After she passed away, the accounts of her mythical figure attracted several scientists to unearth her story, and Zana's bones were exhumed. Our study intends both to reveal true human nature of Zana and grant her and her descendants remains the dignity they deserve. Yeah, it turns into a very sad story when you reframe all the stories about her as she was a runaway slave.
Yeah, which you kind of get the feeling of. Now, the really fucked up thing is this isn't the first time that we've covered a topic like this on the podcast. There was the other one. What was her name? We covered her very early on, and she was a part of, it's the one that I originally said. She was a part of like a traveling freak show.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember her name too.
And she was fairly famous the same way, and it was exactly the same.
If you look into anything from the 1800s, it was something really racist, probably.
Yeah, it actually ended about exactly the same, that she was like a slave from Africa and they called her Bigfoot. Yep.
But yeah, Chelsea, any questions about that story? I think it's pretty laid to rest in like fairly open and shut that this is exactly what it was.
Yeah, it's a good episode. I like this story. It was pretty apparent, though, that even if it was a Bigfoot, they're definitely abusing that Bigfoot. But in the end, it just speaks to humanity. And
no, she liked to swim in the river in winter and to sleep outside all the time.
Yeah, to dig a hole to sleep in outside.
And be prodded by the children.
Yep. And was referred to as the boogeyman to scare the children. And in the end, it just isn't humanity great kind of thing.
Yeah, you like to think it was like 100 years ago was different, but we're really still pretty terrible.
I would like to think we don't do things like this anymore, but we're just doing different horrible things now.
And we just like kind of pick different groups to differentiate ourselves from.
Yeah.
But that's probably enough introspection for that. It's a fun Bigfoot story until you look into it even a little.
Until you listen to the whole episode.
With that, I have been Taylor, here with Chelsea. We are Journey to the Fringe. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Journey to the Fringe. If you have liked what you have listened to, please like, share, subscribe, or follow, depending on what venue you are listening to us through. Also, please, if possible, leave a 5-star review, as that really helps us in the algorithms. Should you wish to interact with us, please check us out on your social media of choice. I bet you we are there. And if you really want to communicate with us and give us ideas for new episodes or tell us that we're wrong and terrible, either way, please send us an email at journeytothefringe@gmail.com. For now, I'll see you in the next episode.